This Trump whispering stuff's no walk in the park, nor the Rose Garden. For all of Emmanuel Macron's Monday bro shakes, flattery, and gentle rebukes, the U.S. then went on to side with Russia and North Korea on Ukraine at the United Nations. Maybe one session wasn't enough. Enter Keir Starmer, whose job is arguably harder. Trump prefers presidents and kings. Also, post-Brexit Britain's arguably in a tighter financial bind than even deficit-happy France. Yes, in a sign of the times, the prime minister wants to pay for more defense spending with cuts to international aid funding. Starmer is trying the sober approach, warning that a U.S. backstop remains vital to any European defense initiative. We'll ask if citizens on both sides of the channel have the stomach to pay more for security in an age of volatile politics and a warming of ties between Trump and Putin, and how the next visitor to the Oval Office will fare, Volodymyr Zelensky, who the U.S. has told to sign Friday on the dotted line for a minerals deal with D.C. in exchange for what is still unclear. Today in the France 24 debate, what can old allies do to convince Trump on Ukraine? With us, his postings have included Moscow, and for France 24, he's covered both sides of the front line on this one. Robert Parsons, it's with a heavy heart that we welcome you on this penultimate day as Chief International Affairs Editor. Yep. Thanks for being with us. With us as well, Samantha De Bender, an Associate Fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Good
Hello.
To see you. From London, the author of Red Notice, which chronicles his personal run-ins with Vladimir Putin, Bill Browder, CEO of Hermitage Capital. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, John Hardy, Deputy Director of the Russia Program at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies think tank. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Let's begin with the latest from the White House, Robert Parsons. Donald Trump, who's accepted an invitation, which was expected for a state visit to Britain to see King Charles. These sort of very protocol announcements, they matter at this moment?
With Donald Trump, perhaps they do. You know, it's clear that Emmanuel Macron adopts an approach where he likes to stroke Donald Trump's ego, and it seems to work with him. I think it's worked in a sense. I think there's been a little shift in the Trump position. I mean, I don't think we were expecting after Macron went to Washington that Donald Trump would suddenly shift his position and start agreeing with Macron. But I think there has been a slight shift in his position. I don't think he's on the same rails as before. And I think Starmer will try to move and push the envelope a little bit further.
But again, after that sequence with Macron, we saw the U.S. side with Russia and North Korea and Belarus on a Ukraine resolution.
Well, you know, I'm not even sure you can say that, to be honest. I personally, I wouldn't interpret it that way. I think what they're trying to do, I think, is to try and shift things a little bit on Ukraine. There, as for the resolution, there have been so many resolutions since the start of the war in Ukraine, and none of them have got anywhere because the Russian automatically put their veto forward. So I think this was an attempt just to try and shift things forward to get to the next stage of negotiating a peace deal.
You agree, Samantha De Bender?
Unfortunately, I don't agree. I think that we saw one thing during the Macron-Trump meeting, which was a lot of sort of bromance-type hugging and hands on the knees and a lot of jovial bonhomie. But one commentator in France said it was like seeing two swimmers swimming in a lane, doing very well in their own lane, but with having absolutely nothing to do with each other and both coming out of the pool and saying, hey, we did really well. There's nothing concrete actually came after that meeting.
But what would you expect?
I'm sorry. No, but I would perhaps expect that the next day that the United Nations, the United States would not vote with North Korea, Belarus, Russia, and Iran. And
I'm sorry,
I'm sorry. These optics really, really count. If you put it on a map and color the different countries with different colors according to how they voted, you see the U.S. seems to have fallen completely onto the other side. There was the second resolution at the UN last week as well that was a resolution the U.S. had put forward, but there were some amendments that were made to that resolution that were accepted by the Secretary General. And after that, the U.S. had to actually abstain from its own resolution. Again, it was reinforcing the language that Ukraine had been invaded. I mean, even China abstained from a resolution that the U.S. Voted against. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. So I don't see what the Macron-Trump meeting happened. And if you see the way Trump is now talking about, well, as far as I understand this afternoon, he's imposing 25% tariffs on the EU, that is hardly a positive result. I would just think that it was a lot of show, but unfortunately not much substance.
So, John Hardy, we had the French ambassador to the United States during Trump's first term. It was on the radio the other morning. And said, the problem is, we in the media, we expect a smackdown when we see these kinds of meetings. But actually, that's not how diplomacy works. Are you ready to give the French president and the UK prime minister a long leash as they try to convince Donald Trump?
Well, I think what was really important coming out of the Macron meeting and what will be important with the Starmer meeting is, you know, you're not going to get a fulsome guarantee from Donald Trump about what he's going to do on security guarantees, how the U.S. is going to contribute. I think what was important with the Macron meeting is he sort of left the door open. And if you've been following some of his remarks, for example, in yesterday's cabinet meeting, he seemed to indicate some willingness to contribute, again, without making firm commitments. I think for right now, that's probably the best that could be hoped for. And hopefully, you know, as the months wear on, we can get, you know, more of a firm commitment to that plan.
Bill Browder, do you have a playbook to hand for how to handle Donald Trump?
Well, I'm not sure how to handle Donald Trump. I mean, I think that everybody is being very polite here. Let's just look at what's happened. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is siding with Putin. He's called Zelensky the dictator. There's now an instruction inside his administration that nobody can call Putin the aggressor, that Russia didn't invade. And it's remarkable to watch all these different characters, all these different high-level people all beating around the bush. Like, and when they're asked, did Russia invade Ukraine, they're unable to say so. And so I think that the situation is actually a lot worse than any of us can really admit here right now.
We're confused, Bill Browder, because on the one day he calls him a dictator, but on Friday he's meeting him at the White House. So is it all just a bit of bluster and an infotainment?
No, not at all. In fact, what I understand is that he was planning on canceling that meeting, and it was only with the desperate plea of Emmanuel Macron that he had decided to put that meeting back on the books. This is not a situation in which we're dealing with equal sides. We're on one side. He thinks, you know, Ukraine has got some points, and on the other side, Putin's got some points. No, he's hostile towards Ukraine, and he is extremely warm and flattering towards Vladimir Putin. Until he does something in action that proves otherwise, we should believe what he's done and what he's said. He's switched sides here.
Which brings us to Keir Starmer, who has his work cut out. The UK Prime Minister, who before setting out for Washington, announced that the UK would up its defense spending, as we said at the outset, a little bit at the expense of international development aid. But again, clearly with a mind getting in the good graces of Donald Trump, that he's moved forward the announcement on that spending. Starmer, who served up sobering scenarios in the House of Commons on Wednesday.
The worst of all outcomes, if there's to be a cessation of hostilities, is that it is a short break rather than sustained and lasting peace. And I think that that means there's got to be security guarantees. I've indicated that we will play our full part. There has to be US backing, because otherwise I don't think it will deter Putin.
There has to be US backing, Samantha DeBender. And of course, this is in the context of those two totally non-NATO NATO meetings that Emmanuel Macron hosted, and the third one to come when Starmer on Sunday briefs certain powers in London.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit perplexed about all these meetings about troops on the ground, because the Russians are still being very clear that they do not want any European troops on the ground in Ukraine, safeguarding whatever peace may or may not come out of this. Now, Keir Starmer's position is very clear. It is troops on the ground in the context of a peace deal, whatever peace deal that may be.
And that you need the United States, was
well,
we heard in that clip.
What he means by that is he means he would need United States for backing in terms of logistics, in terms of intelligence, and in terms of transport. That is what he's hoping the
Can
UK...
Can it be done without the US?
In terms of logistics, it would be very difficult. In terms of transport as well, and in terms of intelligence, more or less impossible at the moment, considering the dependence that all of Europe, and particularly the UK, still have on US intelligence. But without the US, it should still be possible for Europeans to help some kind of policing of the Black Sea and protection of the Black Sea, and also some kind of protection of Ukraine's sky, which, of course, we've all been saying, oh, we can't do this because it will be escalation. I mean, everything that we didn't do was going to be an escalation until we did it, and there was not an escalation. But there are discussions right now within certain European military headquarters, and that also includes the UK, as to what could be done without the Americans to help Ukraine continue to stand if the United States withdraw immediately, because we're not talking about something that we would need in 5 or 10 years' time. We're talking about something that we'll need potentially even next
but
month.
But allies in 2022 rejected protecting Ukraine's airspace, which was a clear demand then by Volodymyr Zelensky. Why would they change now?
Well, because a number of things. There's a realization that this war is very different when we look at how the airspace is being used. This is overall now a drone war. So drones are being used overwhelmingly to target Ukrainian cities. You do not have to have European pilots shooting down and killing Russian pilots to protect Ukraine's sky today. The same with the missiles. Russian planes are not flying over Ukrainian airspace. So there are a lot of things that could be done to help increase Ukraine's air defense, because air defense is not only from Patriot anti-missile devices on the ground. It could also be done with from planes to help shoot down and to protect Ukraine on these from the missiles and drones, and also in drone jamming technology to vastly increase the help that we give Ukraine in helping them develop drone jamming techniques.
John Hardy, you agree?
I agree that some sort of U.S. contribution will likely be necessary to make that reassurance force arrangement militarily and politically feasible. As I said earlier, it's unclear exactly what the U.S. might provide. I think the Trump administration, for its part, would be well served to provide that clarity sooner rather than later, so that we can actually move this conversation forward. I think right now it's still in the realm of talk, and while it's excellent that European colleagues have begun to sort of recognize the need to step up and ensure their own security, we're still not really at the phase of actual deliverables.
Yeah, and Robert Parsons, it's parallel universes, because while we discuss how much military support could be sent to Ukraine without the United States, the Americans... Well, they had a meeting in Istanbul at the American consulate with their Russian counterparts for the normalization of ties. It's full steam ahead, is?
Yeah, I mean, they've made it clear that they want to establish normal relations with Russia, that without normalization of relations with Russia, trying to get peace with Ukraine is going to be impossible. That I think is the logic of everything they're doing at the moment, that if you want to suck Russia into this deal that they want to get, you have to normalize relations, you have to start putting resolutions before the UN which have a chance of being accepted by Russia rather than being automatically rejected. Whether You may not like their position, but that's the logic of their position, I think. You know, and as for, you know, the backstop that Starmer is creating, absolutely, it's quite clear that, you know, unless there is a US backstop there, it's impossible for any sort of peace deal to hold and any sort of peace deal to take place, to be put in place that could be acceptable to the Europeans. Because the big fear for Europe, of course, is that it's not just Ukraine we're talking about here in this war, but Europe as well. And if the peace deal isn't a firm and lasting one, the threat will be not just to Ukraine, but to Europe as well.
Bill Browder, it's not Donald Trump's first term in office. Why does it feel different this time? What's changed?
Well, I can remember the last time around, you know, there was a lot of talk about his friendship with Putin. And he was saying, you know, Putin is a guy he can get along with and he has a lot of respect for him and so on and so forth. But when you know, and that stuff, of course, was very worrying for anybody who was, you know, sort of anti-Putin. But it didn't really result in dramatic policy changes of the United States towards Russia. They still kept the sanctions in place. There was still sort of a proper, you know, distrust of Putin, as there should be. This time around, we're in a completely different world where he has not just said that he supports Putin, but he's gone out of his way to become sort of friendly to Putin at the expense of his allies, at the expense of us, and at the expense.
Why is that?
Well, we don't know. Nobody knows. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And I always, in my previous life as an investor, we always said if something doesn't make sense on the surface, then we just don't have all the information. And there's obviously some information that would explain this to us, but that's not obvious and not available to us at the moment. But I just want to comment on what everyone else was saying before, which is that there is no negotiation going on. What's happened so far is that Putin, the invader, the person who has invaded Ukraine, has been, Donald Trump has begged him to come to the table. All sorts of people are making concessions. Britain is saying we'll send troops, all sorts of other stuff like that. Trump has demanded various concessions from Ukraine, and Putin has said nothing. He said nothing. He said there is nothing that he's offered. There's nothing that we've demanded. He's just sitting there watching us negotiate with ourselves. And so far, all that's happened is he's gotten the benefit of a 1.5-hour phone call with Donald Trump. He's gotten the benefit of a meeting from Marco Rubio, meeting the foreign minister. He's gotten the benefit of various nice sentiments like Trump said Russia should join the G7, possible lifting of sanctions. He's not offered one concession, nor has he been asked for one concession so far. This is not a negotiation.
John Hardy, is there division within the Trump administration, or is everybody on the same page?
Well, I think the reality is with Donald Trump, you know, he's going to be the negotiator in chief. And so I think sometimes a little bit too much stock is placed into, you know, who's up or who's down. I think he's made his views quite clear that he wants the fighting to end. I think what's concerning to me is I think there seems to be a perception among some, perhaps Donald Trump himself, that
John, I'm going to interrupt you. We're going to cross over to the White House now because we're going to try to catch some live remarks of the U.S. president alongside alongside the British prime minister. All right, we'll try. Sorry about that. But we cut you off prematurely, John Hardy, but we will be going momentarily. You were saying about it's all down to Donald Trump.
Right. And I think something that I hope Mr. Trump will recognize is that, you know, this conflict, this war is not just about land. It's not, you know, just a real estate deal where you can find that magic number that sort of makes everybody, you know, happy. Putin's goals and Ukraine's goals are incompatible. Putin wants to make Ukraine a vassal state. Fortunately, it currently lacks the military means to do so. But I think what this means is that any deal that might emerge from these negotiations is unlikely to resolve the fundamental question at stake in this war. And a follow-on conflict remains a distinct possibility. And so, you know, to my mind, that really puts an imperative on finding ways to continue U.S. military and Western military support for Ukraine, even if the, you know, the peacekeeping force isn't able to come to fruition, that gives Ukraine the best chance to deter the future Russian aggression. And so I think that one thing that really should be looked at further is taking frozen Russian assets and using that to pay for American arms, to kind of shift the burden off the American taxpayer and make that sort of commitment more palatable to Donald Trump.
Bill Browder, before I ask you about the frozen Russian assets, let me just ask you a question, because we've seen a lot of these reports from people who support Ukraine who say, oh, this is the wrong moment to be negotiating with Putin just when Russia's economy is on the ropes. But he's got a wartime economy and he doesn't have to answer to the voters. So is too much being made of the fact that there is high inflation right now in Russia?
Well, we know for sure that Putin's having a hard time, not just with the economy, but with the war. They're losing between 1,000 and 1,500 soldiers a day on the front line. As you mentioned earlier, this is a drone war in which the Ukrainians have mastered the art of drone warfare, and they're picking off Russian soldiers left, right, and center as they try to make progress. And Russia hasn't made a whole lot of progress in this war. And the economy is
sorry,
not doing...
Sorry to speak cynically, Bill Browder, but does it matter? If you're Vladimir Putin, you can have cannon fodder.
Well, you can up to a point. And it's very interesting to watch how he's playing this, because he's gone out and he said, who is the real fodder out there? And so the first bit of fodder were the people who are in the military, and those people pretty much got killed. He then said, okay, who's next? And they went out to the prisons and said to the prisoners, if you sign up, you can have amnesty. And so the prisoners went out there, they got killed. They then started to go out to the regions and say, we'll pay you money to be in the army. And they started at a $4,000 sign-on bonus, and those guys got killed, and they had to keep on raising it till they got to 40,000, and they still can't get people. So then they had to go on and get North Koreans. Why is this all happening? Because Putin doesn't want to go to the general population and say, we're at war and we're going to do a general conscription. Because if he does that, then he loses the support. And it doesn't matter whether it's a democracy or not. People will be really angry if this becomes a war. In fact, he's a war in their minds. In fact, he's so resistant to that they call it, they're so intent on calling it a special military operation that if you call it a war in Russia, you get sentenced to 8 years in jail. And so it's not as if he's totally immune from what the people
from
in
public
Russia
opinion.
Think.
Bill Browder, we are going to cross over to the White House and listen to Donald Trump and Keir Starmer, as promised.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Can I say thank you for your hospitality, for your leadership? We have met a number of times, we've talked a number of times, and we have had a very constructive conversation. I'm sure we will today. And of course, our countries have been bound together for a very long time now. The closest alliance, I think, of any two countries when it comes to prosperity and security. And I know that together we will strengthen that even further. And on issues like Ukraine, thank you for changing the conversation to bring about the possibility that now we can have a peace deal. And we want to work with you to make sure that peace deal is enduring, that it lasts, that it's a deal that goes down as a historic deal that nobody breaches, and we'll work with you to make sure that that absolutely happens. And it is my pleasure to bring from His Majesty the King a letter. He sends his best wishes and his regards, of course, but he also asked me to bear this letter and bring it to you. So can I present the letter from the King to
you? Thank you very much. Am I supposed to read it right now?
Yeah, please do.
I will do.
I've got to tell him what your reaction is, so I need to know. I need to know.
He is a great gentleman. A great, great gentleman. Oh, that's well. Well, that is really nice. I must make sure his signature's on that. Otherwise, it's not quite as meaningful. It is, and that's quite a signature, isn't it? Beautiful. He's a beautiful man, a wonderful man, and we appreciate it. I've known him, gotten to know him very well, actually. First term and now second term. Perhaps you'd like to say what that very important paragraph.
Yes, so this is a letter from His Majesty the King. It's an invitation for a second state visit. This is really special. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. I think that just symbolizes the strength of the relationship between us. So this is a very special letter. I think the last state visit was a tremendous success.
It was.
His Majesty the King wants to make this even better than that. So this is truly historic, an unprecedented second state visit, and he wants to talk that through with you.
And that says at Windsor. That's really something.
Yes. What I haven't got yet is your answer.
Yes.
I do need to.
The answer is yes. On behalf of our wonderful First Lady, Melania, and myself, the answer is yes, and we look forward to being there and honoring the King and honoring really your country. Your country is a fantastic country, and it'll be our honor to be there. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President. I shall happily take that back to His Majesty.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to keep that one.
You'll keep that one.
President Trump, Andrew and Tristan Tate landed in Florida today on a private jet after being released from custody in Romania. They are accused rapists, human traffickers, not thought of as good people in many circles. Did your administration pressure the Romanian government to release them? And if so, why?
I know nothing about that. I don't know. You're saying he's on a plane right now?
He's back. They already been.
Yeah, I just know nothing about it. We'll check it out. We'll let you know.
Obviously, this involves, there's an English element here, so obviously it's important that justice is done, and human trafficking is obviously, to my mind, a security risk. And so we'll catch up with the story in due course.
You're aware. Are you aware? I didn't know anything about it. Yeah.
Mr. President, veterans make up 30% of the federal workforce. Are you tracking how many veterans have been fired so far?
Yes, we are.
We are,
and we take good care of our veterans, so we're watching that very carefully, and we hope it's going to be as small a number as possible. But we are having great success in slimming down our government. It's been really very successful, and some took payouts and buyouts, and others took other things, and some people we're finding out don't even exist. We're finding that we have a lot of people that don't exist, that people thought that did. We will be making a statement on that, but we're taking care of our veterans. We love our veterans. We're going to take good care of them. Okay, please.
Mr. President, could you be persuaded as part of a peace settlement in Ukraine to provide air cover, a backstop security position to the contributions that Europe might make as well?
Well, so President Zelensky is coming to see me on Friday morning. And we're going to be signing really a very important agreement for both sides, because it's really going to get us into that country. We'll be working there. We'll have a lot of people working there. And so in that sense, it's very good. It's a backstop, you could say. I don't think anybody's going to play around if we're there with a lot of workers and having to do with rare earths and other things, which we need for our country. And we appreciate it very much. And I look forward to seeing him. We'll be talking about it, and we'll also be talking about that today with the Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, we've already indicated that we'll play our full part in making sure that any deal, if there is one, and I hope there is, and I think this is a historic moment to make sure it's a lasting deal, and we're about to have a discussion about how we can make that work.
But I have to say this, as I said yesterday, you know, you're talking about a peacekeeping force. We have to make a deal first. Right now, we don't have a deal. We have Russia, we have Ukraine. I think we're very well advanced. I think Russia has been acting very well. We have representatives, Steve Witkoff and Scott and Marco and JD. We're all involved, every one of us, and a lot more. But I think we're very well advanced on a deal, but we have not made a deal yet. So I don't like to talk about peacekeeping until we have a deal. I like to get things done. I don't want to give it the the bad luck sign. We don't want to do that. But we've had very good talks with Russia, and we've had very good talks, as you know, with Ukraine. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, does the Prime Minister have to choose a closer relationship with the EU as he is seeking and a good trade relationship with you? Which one should he go for?
Well, I think we have just a great relationship. We actually had a good relationship before. We've met a couple of times, and I'm very impressed with him. I'm very impressed with his wife, I must say. She's a beautiful, great woman. And I said you're very lucky. He's very lucky. And we've had a very good relationship.
Are you worried about Britain potentially undoing some of the benefits of Brexit by seeking a closer tie with the EU, who you said was set up to screw
No, I don't worry about that. I thought, you know, frankly, what they did was the right thing at the time. And I think that'll probably prove out over the centuries. You know, you have a long time to go. But I think I predicted that was going to happen, and it did happen, and it'll work itself out. I think it's already worked itself out.
Yes. Mr. President, can I ask on Chagos, Mr. President? Keir Starmer has signed the deal to give away the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. Will you approve that deal?
Well, we're going to have some discussions about that very soon, and I have a feeling it's going to work out very well. They're talking about a very long-term, powerful lease, a very strong lease, about 140 years, actually. That's a long time. And I think we'll be inclined to go along with your country. Yeah, I think it sounds. It's a little bit early. We have to be given the details, but it doesn't sound bad. Yeah, please.
Mr. President, you obviously can do business with our Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. You said yesterday that the EU was constructed to screw the US when it comes to trade. What can our Prime Minister say to you to persuade you not to impose tariffs on the United Kingdom?
Yeah, did I use the word that you said, that bad word?
I think so.
Well, I think that the EU, I've had problems with the EU because, and we're not talking about, we happen to have a great relationship with you, but we did have, and we do have problems with the EU because they've tariffed us. They do it in the form of a VAT tax, which is about 20%, and many other taxes. They sue our companies, they sued Apple, got $16 or $17 billion, which was, I think, totally a ridiculous decision. And they're suing Google for a lot of money. They're suing a lot of other companies. And we don't like the way they're treating our people now. We don't like the way they're treating our companies. They sell us cars. We don't sell them cars. They don't take our cars. They don't take much of our agriculture. And we have a deficit with them of about $350 billion. So I wouldn't say it's been such a great relationship personally, but other people did because it's politically correct to say that it's been good, but it hasn't been good. And we're going to change that. And we are going to have reciprocal tariffs. We're not going to have tariffs. We're going to have reciprocal. Whatever they charge us, we're going to charge them, which for many years, foolishly, I would have done that. But then all of a sudden we had COVID and we had other things to think about. So it took me a little while to get that on, but we had in my first 4 years, we had the greatest economy in the history of, I think, the world, but certainly in the history of our country. I think we're going to have that again. But the EU was very, very tough on us in, from the standpoint of trade. Then you could take it a step further and go into NATO, and that was a very tough situation for us. I mean, that's been a very tough situation because we were paying a disproportionate share. And it wasn't good. So, as you know, they paid hundreds of billions of dollars after I got involved, and they evened it out a little bit, but not very much. And then if you look at the war, we're in for $300 billion plus, and they're in for $100 billion. They get their money back, and now we'll get our money back also. But under Biden, you wouldn't have done that. Biden did a terrible job, I have to say. I hate to say that about somebody that sat here just before me, but he did a terrible, terrible job. That war should have never happened, the war between Russia and Ukraine. Frankly, October 7th should have never happened. Israel, that should have never happened. What happened there should have never. Inflation should have never happened. Afghanistan should have never happened. The way they got out, not getting out, but the way they got out. So, but I can say that as far as we're here for a different reason, we're talking about a very different place. And this is some place that I have investments there. I own Turnberry, own Aberdeen, and I own a great place called Doonbeg in Ireland. So, you know, I have a great warm spot for your country?
And our trade, obviously, is fair and balanced, and in fact, you've got a bit of a surplus, so we're in a different position there. And obviously, we've contributed hugely in relation to Ukraine, and taken together with Europe, there's about 50%
it'll work,
yeah. In.
It'll work. It's going to work.
Thank you. So does that mean there won't be any sanctions on the UK then?
We'll have to take a look. I mean, we're going to have a good discussion today, and we have some very talented people on the other side, and we have some people that probably aren't as talented to them, but they're pretty good. Marco, what do you think? Our people are pretty good. And no, we're going to have a good discussion, and we'll be talking about it.
Mr. President. Mr. Starmer, the Prime Minister has said that he believes that Vladimir Putin would be at risk of invading Ukraine again without a sufficient backstop. Do you think that Vladimir Putin would be likely to invade again in the event of a peace deal?
I don't think so. I think when we have a deal, it's going to be the deal. I don't think if I didn't win the election, I don't think we'd be even talking to Putin right now or anybody else. I think it would just, you know, I don't know if you're looking at the stats, but thousands of people are being killed a week, soldiers mostly, because the towns have been destroyed. But thousands of soldiers, this was a very bad week, by the way, I get the stats.
Terrible numbers.
And you're talking about a human life. Number one, I want to see that. And it doesn't involve American soldiers, but it's Russian and Ukrainian soldiers. And I think I'm speaking for both.
Yeah.
Number one, we want to see that stop. And number two, I want to stop paying the kind of money that we're talking about. You know, we're helping, and we're helping NATO, but we're helping a lot, more than anybody else by far. And I want that to stop also.
Mr. President, Jeff, go ahead. Thank you, sir. You talked about trade tariffs this morning on your social media site. Just a question about China. 10% tariffs has already been implemented on China. Are you planning to do
an additional 10 above the
This 10. Will be an additional 10 above. And is there, from the talks with Canada and Mexico so far, are you not seeing the progress that you wanted in order to
extend
that?
I don't see it at all. No, not on drugs. We've done a great job. If you look at Tom Homan, he's been incredible, and Christie, they've done a great job in terms of the border. But the drugs continue to pour into our country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. We're losing substantially more than 100,000 people. I mean, dead. They're dead. The families are destroyed after that happens. So it's, you know, it's not just that. That's the ultimate. But the families are absolutely destroyed. The drugs come in through Mexico. They come, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them come from China. And that's why we did that. It's 10 plus 10.
In 10 case, plus 10
was there confusion on that?
There was, sir, yeah.
Okay, 10 plus 10. It's a second 10. And I think you'll, I think you're going to see, eventually, you're going to see drugs stopping, because the country should not be allowing those drugs to come into the United States of America. And we're not going to allow it to happen. So that goes on the 4th of March. And then on the 2nd of April, we have reciprocal tariffs. That's reciprocal, where we charge countries what they're charging us. And nobody should have a problem with that. We have reciprocal. It's reciprocity. It's something that I think everybody I've spoken to said that's fair. And it is. If somebody charges us 25%, we charge them 25. If somebody charges us 10 or 15 or 30 or 70, we charge them an exact like amount. And it's pretty simple, but it's reciprocal tariffs, because the United States has been taken advantage of by many, many different countries, including our friends, friend and foe. And in many cases, our friends took bigger advantage of. When you talk about the EU, we're talking about the EU. The EU has been really a very bad to us in terms of trade. And I'm a different kind of a president. I can't let that happen. Thank you. Please, ma'am, go ahead.
Mr. President, what would you be willing to do if Vladimir Putin did not stick to the terms of any deal on Ukraine?
If he not what?
He did not stick to the terms of any deal on Ukraine, because he has a history of not sticking to his word when it comes to international agreements.
I think he'll keep his word. I think he's, I've spoken to him, I've known him for a long time now, you know, I've known him. We had to go through the Russian hoax together. That was not a good thing. It's not fair. That was a rigged deal and had nothing to do with Russia. It was a rigged deal with inside the country, and they had to put up with that too. They put up with a lot. It wasn't just us. They had to put up with it, with a phony story that was made up. I've known him for a long time now, and I think he will, I don't believe he's going to violate his word. I don't think he'll be back when we make a deal. I think the deal is going to hold. Now, they're going to have security. You're going to have security. Yep. You're going to have soldiers. I know France wants to be there. He's the president has said he wants to have soldiers there. I don't think we're going to even be necessary, but I don't think there'll be any problem with keeping the deal with the security.
We're going to discuss that.
You want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I mean, the deal, if we get it, is going to be hugely important. I don't think it would have happened if the space hadn't been created for it by yourself. But if there's a deal in, we've got to make sure it's a deal that lasts, that is not temporary, that lasts, and that's why we need to make sure that it's secure, and we've lent in and said we'll play our part, and we've talked and we will talk about how we work with yourself, Mr. President, to ensure that this deal is something which is not violated, because it's very important that if there is a deal, we keep it.
And that will be, and I think I can say that will be the easy part. That's the part we look forward to, because putting security there, that's the part we all look forward to. That's easy. The difficult part is getting the deal made. So, yep. But I think we've come a long way. Did you have something?
Yeah, on the personal level.
He's got such a nice face.
Oh.
He's smiling. No, he's smiling. But watch, he'll ask a total killer question.
I've known him a long time.
Yeah, the ones that get you. No, he looks like a nice guy.
On a personal level, Mr. President, what do you get on most? What's your common ground with Sir Keir Starmer? Because you're both from different political backgrounds.
It's true. I think I can say this because we've known each other now really for a little while. This is not our first meeting, as you know. He loves his country, and so do I. That's our common theme. He loves his country, and I love our country. And we also have two countries that have gotten along for the longest period of time.
Yeah.
Number one ally on each side. And we have good. France and Australia. We have a lot of good ones. But we've had a long-time relationship. A long time, hundreds of years, and we like each other, frankly, and we like each other's country, and we love our country, and I think that's our common thread.
Okay? Mr. President, the Europeans.
Sir, yeah, please.
On tariffs, you just said with China.
Who are you with?
I'm with the Independent.
Oh, that's good.
It's on tariffs. You just said with China.
Thank you.
We charge them. We charge them as we charge China, but the tariffs are paid eventually by American importers and consumers.
No, they're not. No, I think they're paid for by the country. But, you know, look, we can get into that. I put a lot of tariffs on in my first term, and we made tremendous amounts of progress because of those tariffs. China paid us hundreds of billions of dollars, billions. We never had a, because they took advantage. And President Xi's a friend of mine, but he knows better than anybody took advantage of our country. He took advantage of presidents that didn't know what they were doing. And they expect them.
Their remarks made a short while ago before Keir Starmer and Donald Trump retired to private discussions inside of the White House. So we're in the company of John Hardy, Bill Browder, of Samantha DeBender, and Robert Parsons. Rob, very different from what we heard Monday, or is it the similar hits, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar because, you know, what we're seeing is Macron Monday, Starmer today, trying to see where this is going and making sure, or trying to make sure, that Donald Trump stays on track, that there will be security guarantees, that he doesn't completely trust any sort of deal that he agrees to with Vladimir Putin. The concern is that, you know, he could sell everything to the Russians and there will be no safety to fall back on. You know, that I think is what the position of both Macron and Starmer is at the moment. You know, whether or not they're right to think they can influence him is a different matter, but that's where they go. That's where they're trying
to
go. So
Keir Starmer slightly less tactical than Emmanuel Macron, a little less touching, but there's the same kind of trying to rub Donald Trump the right way. How's that going to play in the British press?
I think, well, it depends which. The British press is actually very varied. I think that I'm not sure how the letter from the King is going to play to the British press, because Keir Starmer very much looked like the King's envoy. You know, President Macron was there as the president, as high as you get. Keir Starmer's a prime minister, and as you mentioned at the beginning of our show this evening, you know, President Trump likes kings and he likes presidents, and Keir Starmer is a prime minister. So I think the British press will probably pick up on the body language, the difference in body language between the two men, that Macron was very, very at ease, imitating Trump's body language. Keir Starmer was much more rigid, much more formal. There were no thumbs up together when they entered the White House. So I suspect the British press will talk about that. It depends whether they are more conservative-leaning or more Labour-leaning.
All right, we're almost out of time. Bill Browder, we heard in the press conference Donald Trump saying, oh, did I say those things about the EU? Did I use those words? He also said later on, did I call Zelensky a dictator? How does that bode for that Friday meeting where they're supposed to sign that minerals deal?
Well, I think that actually what I thought was the most significant answer in that little press conference was what Donald Trump didn't say. And everybody pressed him, including Prime Minister Keir Starmer, that on security guarantees, and he dodged that question. He dodged that question with Macron. He dodged that question with Starmer. And I imagine he's going to dodge that question with Zelensky on Friday. And so that, in my mind, that is the crucial element of this whole thing. That's what everybody is there for, is to say, okay, if a deal gets done and Europe provides peacekeepers, what's America going to do? And he's held back on that one, which is, you know, maybe there'll be more after the conversations. Maybe there'll be more after this lovely invitation by the king. But at this point in time, we are where we were before.
All right. We'll have to unfortunately leave it there. Bill Browder, I want to thank you so much for joining us from London. John Hardy from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Samantha De Bendren. Robert Parsons for your finale. But you will be back, sir, on this set. Thanks.
With pleasure, yeah.
All right, our chief international affairs editor. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.